Recently, I read a story about a person who, dare I say, had one of the roughest childhoods that I've ever read about. You know, you sometimes think about your own childhood and you're like, oh, I hate my parents, I hate my life, everything's bad. And then you read stories like this and you're like, okay, so my life was really not that bad. This gentleman, it all started with his stepdad. His biological father, who was married, and his biological father decided that his wife wasn't enough for him. And so one evening, this father finds himself in the arms of another woman for one night who made it her business to get paid for these types of things. And lo and behold, she gets pregnant. One night stand. We don't know all of the reasons why. I couldn't figure it all out. But the mom, the lady, she did not wish to keep the child. So though she probably had good rights to be able to keep it, maybe it was because of her profession, maybe it was because she wanted to return back to what she did for a living, maybe there was just concern for the child that there's no way we're going to put him with the mom because the mom's a train wreck. So the father took in this child. And so this kid is growing up not really knowing his mom because his mom is out doing things, and there's dad, and of course, I would probably venture a guess that the home life wasn't really stable, because what ended up happening was then his stepmom and his stepbrothers hated him. I mean, wouldn't you? Like, if you were the mom and you looked over and you see, here's your husband, and then here is a child by your husband and another woman, and now you have to raise this child. And there were concerns about inheritance issues. Like, who gets the fortune? Does this illegitimate child, do they deserve anything from the family? The story didn't actually say it, but I think we could probably all imagine how hard it must have been growing up being hated by a stepmother and stepbrothers. And I'm not just talking like it's a wicked stepmom that's, you know, just kind of cruel or strict. You could imagine that this woman looks at this child every single day and is reminded of the infidelity of her husband. How would that make you feel if you were a mom at that point? You'd be angry. You're probably lashing out at your husband, and deservedly so, but also then this kid who is this reminder of your husband's idiotic actions. So every day, I'm certain this child was told, you are not wanted here, you are not loved, and I'm sure that this stepmother, showering her love on her biological children, but then looking at this other kid and just showing no affection. Could you imagine growing up in this household? Could you imagine that these brothers, what ended up happening was these brothers, I guess you could say, toughened him up. This kid became extremely strong. And probably because his brothers are every day beating him up. Could you imagine that? Growing up every day thinking, I can't even be at home and wonder about my safety because I've got these stepbrothers who absolutely hate me, and every day there's a fight. The one saving grace about it was he did become strong. He became able to fight, he became muscular, and he became known as a scrappy kid that could really do a lot of damage if need be. And then one day, probably when he turned of age, mom and brothers come to him and say, time for you to go. Kicked out of the house. Probably at 18, maybe a little bit earlier. And now this kid, who has had absolutely zero love his entire life. I wonder how much love he received from his father. I mean, wouldn't that be tough? Here you are, the biological father, and you try and show love, but the moment you show love to that kid, you're probably receiving a lot of hatred from the wife, right? So this kid growing up constantly in this anger household, what do? Kicked out, fend for yourself. He fell into a gang, and this gang was not a very good gang. It was known specifically for its stealing. It was a bad crowd. So if you ever start thinking to yourself, wow, my childhood's terrible. I hate my parents. They're so mean to me. You just have to go back to Judges 11, and you'll read the story of the judge named Jephthah, who is this person I've been referring to this whole time. Chapter 11, verse 1, it refers, Jephthah the Gileadite was a mighty warrior, which means he's strong, he's muscular, probably because of his upbringing, being beaten up every day by his brothers. His father was Gilead, that was the dad's name, Gilead. His mother was a prostitute. Fabulous. And that's how he grew up. Gilead's wife also bore him sons, and when they were grown up, they drove Jephthah away. You are not going to get any inheritance in our family, they said, because you are the son of another woman. So Jephthah fled from his brothers and settled in the land of Tob, where a group of adventurers. Yeah, it's not quite an accurate translation. Gang of scoundrels. Yes, that's a little bit more reflective of what the original Hebrew is trying to say. Yeah, adventurers. You know, it's like he joined the Boy Scouts, and you know, we went camping a lot, and oh, what fun! No, it's like, what was that? Yeah, Robin Hood's merry men. Yeah, this is not some. Yeah, he's not Little John. These people are robbers and scoundrels. Yeah, babe. Good for nothing men. Yeah, that's pretty darn accurate. Yeah, they're not adventurers. So essentially, this is the equivalent of what we would call a gang, and these people would go around, and Jephthah became kind of the leader. Well, he was probably the strongest, and he's out, and because he had absolutely no love, he's probably filled. What would you be filled with if that was your childhood? You'd be tons of hatred. You would have absolutely no care and concern for any human life, right? Was any care and concern given to you by anyone growing up? No. So he goes around treating other people the way he's been treated. He just doesn't know any different. He is, again, talk about a rough childhood, right? I'm really glad this particular sermon didn't land next week, because it might have ended up being a great Father's Day sermon. Like, fathers, don't be stupid, you know, don't be an idiot. Or maybe it would make you feel better, like, hey, yeah, look at your kids. You're like, okay, your life ain't that bad, okay? I'm not as bad as Gilead. That might be a great way to do it. So Jephthah, this strong man from the Gileadites, ends up leading a different group of people. Verse 4, sometime later when the Ammonites made war on Israel, the elders of Gilead went to Jephthah from the land of Tob. Come, they said, be our commander so we can fight the Ammonites. It's a throwback. Last week as we launched into, we had Tola and Jair. There are two judges we know very little about. And then we find out that the Ammonites are going into this area, this land of Gilead, and they're really nasty people themselves. And so the people in the area of Gilead, where this guy is named after, they're like, we're in a lot of trouble. We need someone strong. We need a mighty warrior. Do we have any mighty warriors available? And then someone, I'm sure, like raised their hand, like, we just kicked one out. Would that be good? Yeah. And so they're like, man, what we really need is Jephthah. They swallow their pride. They get the delegation together, and they go down to Jephthah, and they're like, hey, Jephthah. Oh, yeah, nice tattoo there, Jephthah. That's great. Yeah, nice biker gang you got going on here. That's fabulous. Jephthah, we're in a little bit of trouble. We got some bad guys, and you're kind of a bad guy. So we're thinking that maybe you could come, and you could, like, kick out these people? How would you respond if you were Jephthah? Yeah, pound sand, dude. Are you kidding me? My whole life has been nothing but hatred and anger. I was kicked out of the house. I was sent packing. And now you're going to come to me and ask for a favor? Ain't going to happen. This was Jephthah's response. Verse 7, thank you. Jephthah said to them, "Didn't you hate me and drive me from my father's house? Why do you come to me now when you're in trouble?" The very human response. I don't blame Jephthah. I think that all of us probably would have responded the exact same way. They have a proposition for him. The elders of Gilead said to him, "Nevertheless, we are turning to you now." It's funny they didn't answer the question, right? Because he asked, why did you drive me out? Why did you hate me? And didn't you know this? And why do you come to me now when you're in trouble? And they're like, forget about all that. Sounds like a politician answering a question. Don't answer the question, just talk about something else. "Nevertheless, we are turning to you now. Come with us to fight the Ammonites, and you will be our head over all who live in Gilead." Oh, so sweetens the deal. Don't just come and fight for us, but if you come and fight, we'll make you the leader. Sound like a great plan? Well, now all of a sudden, Jephthah's probably reconsidering his offer, thinking this might be a positive thing. I could actually get back with my family. I know people who grew up in horrible households, and one of the things that they are always trying to do is they are always trying to gain the acceptance of parents who hate them. I know kids who have been abused, and all they want to do is somehow gain the acceptance of their abuser. It's just this natural thing. So Jephthah is thinking to himself, well, gosh, if I go back, now I can finally redeem myself. I'm going to be no longer hated. I'm going to be no longer unloved and cast out. I will no longer be an outcast in society. And don't we do that? Whenever we're the outcasts, what do we try and do? We're always trying to break in, right? We want to be amongst popular people. We want to be acknowledged for our gifts. And that's where Jephthah finds himself. It's a very human response. Verse 9, Jephthah answered, "Suppose you take me back to fight the Ammonites and the Lord gives them to me, will I really be your head?" Did you see the word Lord? Is that in all caps? If it's in all caps, and what he's doing, he is invoking the personal name of Yahweh. That's pretty impressive. A kid who has hated his whole life, an outcast, ends up becoming a strong punk thug who gets around a band of other people, but somewhere deep down in his soul, he still knows something, that Yahweh is in control. His life is not reflecting it. He is not living in the will of Yahweh at that time, but he still has that faith, and he's able to say, if this works, and Yahweh gives them into our hands, then I'll be your head. If Yahweh does this, he's already saying, look, I've got the muscles, I've got the strength, I've got the strappiness, but Yahweh's got to be the one to do this. And he asked, will this actually work? Am I really going to is this going to work? And the elders of Gilead replied, the Lord is our witness. We will certainly do as you say. So Jephthah went to the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head and commander over them, and he repeated all the words before the Lord in Mizpah. Mizpah was a place where it was very frequently, I don't know why, it's probably from the days of Joshua when they came into the land. Mizpah was the place of covenants. It was the place of promises. So they go to the place of covenants and promises, and they say, we promise that if this works, if our ruse works, if you, the leader, can drive out the Ammonites, you'll be our leader. Sounds interesting. I'll make a point here because I think it's important. Later on, we're going to get sidetracked into other points, but this, I think, is huge. How often do we find ourselves judging people based upon things they can't control? Did Jephthah have control over who his parents were? His dad, who was an idiot, and his mom, who was a hooker? Was that his fault? We often blame children and we take out our issues and our anger against children when they didn't ask for this. They just happened to be in it. And I think that we all hate it when people judge us just simply based on outside appearances or maybe our past or maybe our parents. And we hate it when people say, why don't you take the time to at least understand it? Or if nothing else, see that things are out of my control and I can't do anything about this. So at least treat me like a decent human being. And if that's what we want other people to do to us, why do we not do it to others? Why is our lives consumed? Still, it's still... I know, we're supposed to be this society that has really turned a corner, and I think we've made a lot of strides, and that's a good thing, but I think somewhere deep inside of us, we size people up. Someone walks in, and the first thing we do is we judge them up and down. Maybe we're looking at their height. Maybe we're looking at their weight. Maybe we're looking at the color of their skin. Maybe we know that they are the child of someone we don't like. Maybe they've had a bad history. Maybe it was a girl who got pregnant as a teenager. Maybe it was a boy who ended up in a gang but still is trying to now turn his life around. When do we start saying, okay, you know what? Can God use you? Would you be okay with that? Like, what happens if I say, you know what? This Searchlight thing, I'm out. And in comes a dude who has an unfaithful father, a hooker for a mother, and he's been running around with gangs his whole life, but now he wants to tell you all about God's love and be your leader. You good with that? I think most of us would be like, ugh. But that's what we do. We are constantly judging leaders and people like that instead of saying, maybe that God can use these people. Because I tell you this, if you are waiting around to be used by God until your life is all together, you'll be waiting a long time. I think the people we disqualify the most are ourselves. God could never use us because I've done some pretty terrible things. I hear that all the time. Even still, oh, yeah, Pastor, I don't think God could forgive me for the stuff I've done. Really? He used Jephthah. He used David, a murderer and an infidel. He used Noah, a drunk. Over and over again, we see that, and this is one of those things that we don't study the book of Judges to raise up a judge and go, oh, wow, what a great person. We should follow and emulate him. No, we should look at the judges and go, these people are train wrecks. They are a hot mess. God is amazing that he would dare even use someone like that. Because if he can use Jephthah, I have a feeling that he could probably use you. Because you might be thinking, okay, so I've, you know, my dad's not a Flanderan, my mom's not a hooker, and I haven't joined a gang, and, you know, I don't run around with unsavory people. I'm a pretty good, decent kid, right? Well, if that means God can use Jephthah, God can use you. Off my soapbox, let's continue with the story. 12? Thank you. Then Jephthah sent messengers to the Ammonite king with the question, what do you have against us that you have attacked our country? This is crazy. This is the nuttiest ploy that has ever been done in Scripture. You've got Jephthah. He's a bad dude. You would think, let's put him in front of the army and let's let him run down the hill and he can scream and yell and he just have some blood in his teeth and he's swinging swords. We could drive these people out, right? Isn't that why we hired him? We hired you, Jephthah, because you are bad and you are going to take names. You're going to go and destroy these people. You would be the perfect Oakland Raider. Yeah. Sorry, I saw Eric back there and he's got his Raider gears on, so I had to reference the Raiders. Jephthah does the weirdest thing. He sends a message to the king. Hey, why are you attacking us? He's going to try diplomacy. Isn't that nutty? I love it. And as best as we can tell, Jephthah, though his life is not fully together, still seems to have a connection with Yahweh, a connection with God, that he seems to follow along as best as he can. Please, do not mistaken me. Jephthah makes some pretty terrible errors coming up here really soon. But at the same time, he's at least doing something that shows a resemblance of I'm trying to act somewhat by faith, right? And of course, I personally think that's all of us, right? Let me dig into your life for a while and see how good you are. And then, you know, you come here, oh, but look at me, I come to church and my life's all together and, you know, I'm trying to follow God, but, oh, let me tell you, I could probably spend 24 hours with you and your life would be worse than Jephthah. Jephthah, he makes mistakes, don't get me wrong, doesn't disqualify. So, what have you done against, what have we done, what do you have against us that you've attacked our country? The king of the Ammonites answered Jephthah's messengers, when Israel came up out of Egypt, they took away my land from the Arnon to the Jabbok, all the way to the Jordan. Now give it back peaceably. So they're like, well, see, you came in, there's a dude named Joshua, and you know, he comes in and he takes over this land, and you all say this land is your land, and this land is my, no, this land is your land, and Yahweh. And so he's got, I think it's actually a rather decent argument from the king of Ammon, like, you know, you took this land, can we have it back, please? Right, when the bully comes and steals your lunch money, and you're like, oh, bully, please, can I have my, no, that's how king of Ammon, but Jephthah, this is brilliant. This is what Jephthah says. Israel did not take the land of Moab or the land of the Ammonites. But when they came up out of Egypt, Israel went through the desert to the Red Sea and on to Kadesh. Then Israel sent messengers to the king of Edom saying, give us permission to go through your country. But the king of Edom would not listen. They sent also to the king of Moab, and he refused. So Israel stayed at Kadesh. Next, they traveled through the desert, skirted the lands of Edom and Moab, passed along the eastern side of the country of Moab, and camped on the other side of the Arnon. They did not enter the territory of Moab, for Arnon was its borders. Then Israel sent messengers to Sihon, king of the Amorites, who ruled in Heshbon, and he said to him, let us pass through your country to our own place. Sihon, however, did not trust Israel to pass through his territory. He mustered all his men and encamped at Jahaz and fought with Israel. Then the Lord, the God of Israel, gave Sihon and all his men into Israel's hand, and they defeated him. Israel took over all the land of the Amorites who lived in that country, capturing it from the Arnon to the Jabbok and from the desert to the Jordan. Okay, let me summarize. What he's saying is, look, we were traveling and we were being really nice and we were playing ball and we got to this thing and we're like, if we could cut through this land, we could get to our destination a little bit quicker. It's a nice little shortcut, but we're going to go through some other territories. So instead of just marching through saying, we're the Israelites, get out of our way, they sent in a delegation to the king saying, king, can we, like, we're going to just come right on through your land. We're not going to touch anything, okay? And go right on through. Is this good with you? Can we just walk through? And the king said, no! Cool, okay, all right. Let's keep going. Ah, another shortcut. Okay, good. Maybe we can get through here. So they sent another message, and that king came back and said, no, and didn't just say no, but then sent an army down and started attacking him. What Jephthah is saying is, look, you threw the first punch, my friend. We were trying to be nice. We were trying to be peaceful. We were walking through, and all you wanted to do was fight. So you came down, and you fought against us, and all we did was defend ourselves, but our God made it very clear we were in the right. And so, sorry, this wasn't something that we came in and said, we are all that in a bag of chips. You started this whole thing. So it's crazy. Jephthah, again, gives them a history lesson, which tells you something else. Is Jephthah just a dumb thug? No. This is what we often do. We look at people, judge them up and down. Oh, they, you know, ride this type of motorcycle. Oh, they wear this type of clothes. Oh, they put their hair this way. And we immediately judge. Judge of their intelligence. And Jephthah was one who was extremely intelligent. He knows his history very well. And then he finishes up, 23. Now, since the Lord, the God of Israel, has driven the Amorites out before his people Israel, what right do you have to take it over? Will you not take what your God Chemosh sends you, gives you? So he's saying, look, this is what we all do. We all say, okay, you've got your God, I've got my God. Which God is bigger? Which God is badder? Which God is more powerful, right? They had the bumper stickers, my God could beat up your God. And they used to put them on the chariots all over the place. And they said, look, this is what you do all the time. You go and you drive around and you try to take over land and you dedicate it to your God. Our God, we're coming through peaceably and you pick a fight and we win. Yeah, that's because Yahweh is better than Chemosh. Likewise, whatever the Lord our God has given us, we will possess. Are you better than Balak, son of Zippor? I'm not going to go into that. That's a Joshua story. It was a great story. No, it was a number story. Did he ever quarrel with Israel, fight with them? For 300 years, Israel occupied Heshbon, Aroer, the surrounding settlements, and all the towns along the Arnon. They're like, dude, this has been settled for 300 years, and you're now going to bring this up? I have not wronged you, but you are doing me wrong by waging war against me. Let the Lord, the judge, decide this dispute to this day between the Israelites and the Ammonites. Because remember, who started this fight? Who started this particular fight with the between the Israelites and the Ammonites? It was the Ammonites. They were the ones that walked in and said, we're going to start taking over. So he's like, you guys are hypocrites. Let's see if Amnon responds to diplomacy. Because, right, doesn't everyone respond to diplomacy? The king of Ammon, however, paid no attention to the message Jephthah sent him. Great. So the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah. He crossed Gilead and Manasseh, passed through Mizpah of Gilead, and from there he advanced against the Ammonites. So he's like, okay, you know what? We tried talking nicely. Now I'm going to kick your butt. And Jephthah, okay, here we go. This is where it gets dicey. Stick with me. This is now the second time I've preached this in a couple of months. I preached the same message actually down at Concordia, and I got a lot of good stuff. And then this time through, I got even more stuff. So stick with me. Jephthah does something dumb. Much like his father, who made a rash decision to sleep in the bed of another woman, Jephthah makes a vow to the Lord. If you give the Ammonites into my hands, whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me when I return in triumph from the Ammonites will be the Lord's, and I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering. Okay, now, what are we hoping is going to come out of the house? Yeah, well, I hope it's not the dog. I hope it's the cat. I mean, that's my... Yeah, I'm hoping it's the cats, because as we all know, cats are evil, right? And they're possessed by the devil. Yes, we already know. I have proof. I've shown videos of how evil cats are. Okay, so maybe it wasn't the cat. Maybe it was the family goat. His wife. By the way, you don't know this yet, but Jephthah is married and has a kid. So that was not part of the story, but it is true. He's married and has a kid. Mother-in-law, maybe? Yeah. That would, you know, like, oh, hey. Yeah. Mother-in-law comes out. Yeah, you're back. Get to work, you lazy bum. So, oh, God, there she is. Yes, Alex. Yeah. Cats never come out to meet you, right? Yeah, the dogs, you come home, and they're like, you're home, you've been gone for like a whole 10 seconds, I can't believe it, you're back, this is wonderful. Cats, you walk in after, you know, 3 years of being gone, and they're like, oh, you're here. I'm sorry, what? Yeah, and a dog is not a proper sacrifice. This is one of those things where you read it, and you're like, was he just not thinking? Was he just, like... Well, and I know, guys, impulse moment, we're like, hey, I'm going to buy a motorcycle today. And you go and you do it, right? I don't know. It seems to make this decision of I'm going to start here because I'm going to plant some seeds and I'm going to prove something that I think is provable. When you look at that verse that it says, verse 31, whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me when I return to the in triumph from the Ammonites will be the Lord's. And then there's a word there. And, right? I tried all the tricks. This is one of those things where I know Hebrew, but there are certain nuances that have escaped my brain. I did all this study to try to figure it out. But I have heard, I cannot prove this yet, I really need to send a letter to my Hebrew professor or like Mark Brighton down at Concordia. It is a wow consecutive that follows a perfect. And there could be another way to translate it. It's a conjunction type thing. Almost always it's translated and, but with certain verbs, it could also be translated as or. Whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me when I return in triumph from the Ammonites will be the Lord's, or I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering. I don't know if that's true or not. I just plant that seed into your brain because look at what happens. Verse 32. Oh, yeah, sorry. Did Jephthah need to do this? Had God already said, I'm going to give the Ammonites into your hands? Yeah, it had already been settled that they're going to win. And so Jephthah says, hey, God, I'd like to maybe, I don't know, force your hand a little bit. I'm going to manipulate you a little bit. But you know, I know we're going to win, but let me tell you, if we do win, I'm going to give you something. Do you think God's impressed by that? But we do it all the time. Oh, dear Lord, I'm studying for my final. What final you got coming up, Jacob? Math? Or are you already done? You already took math. What do you got coming up here? History. Oh, yeah, history. You got to be in that. You got to do well on this. Dear Lord, I've got my history final coming up, and I didn't study very well. So if you can help me with this, I promise I will study more diligently next time. Have you ever done that? I love it. Everyone's looking over here like, is that what you're doing? No, he's actually studying. That's a good thing. Study, right? No, this did happen to me. I was at Concordia University, Irvine. I remember walking into Roland Mueller's class, and I walk in, and everyone's got their heads down. And I'm like, what are we, like, all in trouble or something? Like, what's going on? Well, you all got your head. Like, and I'm just kind of staring around. And so the people in front of kind of look down, and I realize, oh, they got their heads down because, is that a test? Is there a test today? I had no clue. And then the professor walks over. He's like, here you go, Mr. Manning. And I go, oh, thank you. Got it. Yeah, no problem. Can I borrow a pencil? No, I don't know if I said that. And I sit down and I'm like, and I did. I throw up a quick prayer. Lord, I've not studied for this. But if you help me to do good, I will dedicate my life to you and be a pastor for the rest of my life. No, I didn't actually say that. That's a lie. But wouldn't that be funny if I actually did? But people do that. Did you know that's what Martin Luther did? Martin Luther was walking home one day, and he got caught in a storm, a freak storm, and lightning is striking all over the place, and he's running through this like orchard-type thing, and lightning is hitting, and he's hunkered down, and he prays, Dear St. Anne, well, that's who he's praying to, the Saint. St. Anne, if you save me today, I will become a priest. And he lived that day, and he's like, oh, crud, I made this vow. I think I better do it. Lord, I don't have a boyfriend. My life is so lonely. So if you give me a boyfriend, I'll never ask for another thing the rest of my life. You do this with your parents, I know. Mom, Dad, I want a dog because cats are evil. Can I have a dog? Can I have a dog? No, you're not going to feed it. You're not going to take care of it. And we're going to have to clean up all of its poop. No, Dad, I'll do all of that. I promise. And if you give this to me, I'll never ask for another thing in a day of my life. I'm like, hold on a second. Can I record that? Can you just speak right into here? I almost got like a notary, you know, take it down to a judge. My son will never ask for another thing in a day. No, my kids actually didn't do it. They came close. But yeah, but haven't we all done this? Have we ever tried to manipulate God? God, my life is not going very well, and I don't know what to do. I know I haven't been to church. I know I don't read my Bible. I really hate churches, especially Searchlight Ministries. But if I go, will things be better in my life? We do this all the time. We try to manipulate God as if God's impressed. Like, God owns the universe. And he's like, God, if you do this, I'll give $20 in the offering when I go to church. And he's like, oh, $20, that's fabulous. Like, I've got billions. Thank you very much. I own the stars. I'll do this for you. Yeah, because I'm really impressed by your wonderful little works. Again, we try to show off to God and manipulate him. And this is what Jephthah is doing. Jephthah has this relationship with God, makes this incredible misstep where he says, makes this promise, Lord, if you help me, I'll make the... He did not have to make this promise. But he does it. So, verse 34. Wait, did I do 32? Oh, so then Jephthah went and fought the Ammonites, and the Lord gave them into his hands. So, vow intact. He devastated 20 towns from Aroer to the vicinity of Minnith, as far as Abel-Karamim. Thus Israel subdued Ammon. When Jephthah returned to his home in Mizpah, who should come out to meet him but his daughter, dancing to the sound of tambourines. Daddy, you're home. This is when, if I had a soundtrack, this would be where the record scratch goes. She was an only child. So Jephthah, his wife. Wife might be dead. We don't know. Wife's never mentioned. Of course, I'm sure if the wife was there, she'd be like, Jephthah, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard. In the doghouse. In the cat house. Or something. Yeah, it might be a divorce coming up. I love this, verse 35. Jephthah's response cracks me up. When he saw her, he tore his clothes and cried, "Oh, my daughter, you have made me miserable and wretched." Isn't this great? Like, daddy, I'm home. And he goes, "No, you have made me a wretched man." And then it finally gets disclosed. I made a vow to the Lord that I cannot break. And it doesn't say, but it intimates that he says, I was going to sacrifice the first thing that came out, and you came out. This is all your fault. It doesn't say, but I am pretty certain that Jephthah's daughter did the eye roll. Dad. What would you do? Daughters, if you just found out... Faith, if you just found out that your dad made a vow to the Lord, "Lord, help me with my business, and if I can pay my bills, I'll sacrifice the first thing that comes out of my house," and you come running out, and he's like, "No, you've made me wretched, I now have to kill you," you'd be like, what would you do? I'd run. Yeah, that's what I thought too, like, here comes dad with a knife. I would run. I would pray, I'd run away from home, yeah. Jephthah's daughter, bless her soul, listen to what she says. "My father," she replied, "you have given your word to the Lord. Do to me just as you promised, now that the Lord has avenged you of your enemies, the Ammonites, but grant me this one request." She said, "Give me 2 months to roam the hills and weep with my friends because I will never marry." You almost feel like, does the daughter have more faith than the father? This daughter is just, it blows my mind. Like, well, okay, dad, you made a vow, keep your vow. Which does beg the question, does God, if you make a vow to God, does God expect you to keep that vow? Let's take vows that are maybe less tragic than killing your child. You make a vow to God to... be with someone for the rest of your life, does God expect you to keep that vow? Yeah. If you make a vow, I'm going to be following God for the rest of my life, does God expect you to keep that vow? If you make a vow to your friend to do something for them, and you make a vow like, "No, I promise you before God and everyone else, I will make sure and do this for you," does God expect you to keep that vow? Yeah. This is one of these things where it gets lost in the story of Jephthah because of this idea that there might be this child sacrifice that takes place. But the daughter knows that if you make a vow to God, the idea is you keep that vow. Now, there's one way. Go ahead.
Oh, I was thinking, like, before you make a vow, you should think, does the result of this vow please God?
Yes,
if
yeah.
It doesn't, make
right, yeah. "Dear Lord, I really don't like my middle child, and so can I kill him in your name?" We could pretty much say this, that God is not going to want you to kill your child. There's been stories, though. I mean, there was one that circulated years ago about a woman who was convinced that God wanted her to cook her child, and so she stuffed him in an oven. It was a baby stuffed in the oven, killed him. And she was like, "But God told me to." No, he didn't. I can guarantee it. God, I don't think you want me to go to church. Because, you know, church is a place filled with hypocrites and long-winded pastors. And I don't think you really want me to go to church anymore. You know what? I'll just follow you by myself. No! That's not what God ever... God never... Yeah, ask yourself, as I make this promise, is the outcome of this going to be God-pleasing? If it's not... It's real simple. Don't make the vow. You don't need to manipulate God anyway. God's not manipulated. Like, he's like, "Ooh, I got him trapped now. Yes, yes." Because I think that we are really good at weaseling out of contracts, right? Aren't we? We're always looking for loopholes. Constantly. We don't like maybe a promise that we made to a friend or to a parent or to a child. And so we say, how do I get out of this one? Well, yeah, I know I promised I was going to send you to college and pay for it, but we don't have the money, so maybe I can just weasel out because I don't like the college you're going to. Let's do that. Or, you know I made this promise, but circumstances change, so you know what? Yeah, sorry. When we make promises, God actually expects us to keep those promises. And if they are God-pleasing, then it's good. If it's not God-pleasing, don't do it. God will never ask you. God is never saying, yes, I'm impressed by you making a vow to do something that is unbiblical. So, yay for the daughter. She says, can I hang out with my friends for a couple months? Yeah, typical teenage girl. It's funny because really, her last 2 months, would you want to hang out with your dad for the last 2 months? Like, let's have some daddy-daughter time. No, you want to kill me. I'm going to hang out with my friends. Yeah, great teenage girl. I love it. Well, I love this because she makes the request. I mean, would you have made a request, or would you have put your foot down, done the eye roll, do the hand, the this, the you know, I can't do it. I'm not a girl. But you know what I'm talking about? Like, well, Daddy, you're just stupid. I'm going to go and do this anyway then now. No, she actually makes the request. What is Jephthah going to say? He better say yes. Seems like a reasonable request. You may go. What would have happened if he said, no. Daddy, you're just mean. You may go, he said, and he let her go for 2 months. She and the girls went into the hills. It was like a camping trip. And wept because she would never marry. After the 2 months, she returned to her father, and she went around 13. I know it sounds creepy. Like, would you let your 13-year-old daughter marry right now? No! Different culture. So we would guess maybe 11 or 12. Okay. Did Jephthah kill his daughter? Yeah. This is where, yeah, it's interesting because the text, it becomes ambiguous to a point where you often wonder, is God trying to say something here? If you go to any other commentaries, the majority of the older commentaries all say the same thing. Yes, he, you know, bound her up, tied her up. And by the way, the word for burnt sacrifice is in the Hebrew, it's called holocaust, which we use for something different when we talk about the Jewish persecution and the death of millions of Jewish people. Holocaust simply means a completely burned up offering. So it's, you know, you kill her and then you light the body on fire and then everything burns up. Not even the Darth Vader mask is left. I mean, it's all burned up. It's all gone. I know some of you reacted to that. Thank you for reacting to my little Star Wars reference. I don't believe she died. I don't believe he killed her. And I'm going to tell you why. First off, we do have this option that we can translate the and as or. So he essentially says, look, I'm going to give to you anything that comes out of my house, the first thing that comes out of my house, or I will give it as a burnt offering. I think that might have been something where he said, you know what, I'm trying to impress God so much, so if my daughter or wife or manservant or maidservant or someone else comes out, I'll offer them into the dedication of the temple, but I'm really hoping that the cat comes out first, and then I'll offer that as a burnt offering. It very well could be that he was hedging his bets, because we do that with God often too. It also says that he never killed her, right? I mean, you can read that text over and over. All it says was he did to her as he had promised. Why doesn't it just say, and he killed her? It doesn't. The other thing, too, is where are you allowed to make valid sacrifices to the Lord? At the temple. So could you imagine this, right? He comes walking in, Jephthah and his daughter. He comes to the high priest. I've got an offering today. Well, really, what's that? I don't see any cow or cat or goat or anything like that. No, I'm going to kill my daughter. Do I kill her first? Do you slit her throat? I can't really remember the order, but you know, eventually it's a burnt offering and we're going to burn it up to the Lord. And the high priest says, well, you know, you made a vow, so I guess we'll probably try and do it. Okay, let's, you know, I'll kill her. How about that? No high priest would have ever accepted this because it says all through the Old Testament and the laws, do not kill your children. It is not right. That was what other cultures did. I've mentioned this, how other cultures would take their children and put them on hot stone that is above volcanoes so that when they put them in, they would instantly start melting to the stone and then just get burned up and turn into ash. And they would do this as babies, and they would often put especially baby girls on. This was something that the other cultures did. And God was like, newsflash, I don't like that. I think that's disgusting. I will never honor that. So how in the world could God have even allowed something like this? Yeah. What would it mean to dedicate a kid to the Lord? So what I think probably happened was the very same thing that happened to Samuel. Samuel's mom, unable to get pregnant, she prays and prays and prays. The priest thinks she's a drunk lady. She's like, no, I'm praying to God. I really want a child. And if God gives me a child, I'll dedicate it to the Lord. And so God says, okay, she gets a child. She dedicates him to the Lord. And what happens is that Samuel was essentially given over to the priest at the temple to be raised as like an acolyte, to then learn the priestly functions, even though not born into the priesthood, would become the Lord's. And that person was never allowed to marry and was supposed to dedicate their whole life and service to God. Kind of like what was said here was she never married. It appears so. There was no prohibition against offering whether a son or a daughter to the Lord, as best as we can tell. Yes, Molly. Well, I would be pretty sad too if I had only one kid and I make a rash vow to the Lord, I'll dedicate him to the temple, because what that means is that, well, it's not just inheritance, it's the kid's out of the house. You're not going to see that kid unless you like go. And that's what Samuel's mom did, was like every year she would make a pilgrimage and bring clothes, right, with Samuel's name sewn in the underwear. And it was just something that she always did for him. And so this was essentially saying, and also there would be no inheritance, someone actually did say inheritance, because she's not allowed to marry, there's no kids, and now his stuff is just going to dissipate. So I think he was sad because I really love my daughter and now she's going to be gone. So, yeah. No, we don't know her name. And yeah, we don't know if it's in. It'd be interesting. Oh, there's lots of females after this story. I mean, you got Samson, who likes to hook up with hookers and other people that are also unnamed. But maybe she becomes someone. I don't know. Maybe she's Delilah. I don't know. It seems weird. Alex. Yeah, I don't know exactly the dedication, because the idea behind it is you're making the vow. The purpose behind it was I make a vow to be dedicated to God and I'm married to him, so to speak. That's my thing. So I'm not too sure what happened in the case of Samuel, who was also dedicated but also had kids. But that, I think, is the feeling behind it is, and that's what kind of makes this story make sense. I'm going to dedicate you to the Lord. You can't get married. And she's like, well, this kind of stinks. I really wanted to get married and have kids. And because the interesting thing is, she doesn't say, oh, wow, this really sucks, I'm going to die. She says, oh, this really sucks, I'm never going to get married. Right? Like if you were going to come and kill your kid and your kid, you know, I think your first reaction, if Alex was going to come and kill you, Anna, the first thing would be like, I really don't want to die today. Not, oh, well, I really wanted a boyfriend and get married and have kids. It seems like a disingenuous reaction unless there was something else going on. Yeah. There is something, and again, it's really tough to say, there might be something that the friends, because now she's dedicated and she now is in the temple, they go out to commemorate that she's now no longer their friend. It's like when you lose your best friend and they move away and you're really, really sad about it, you might celebrate nowadays just by Skyping them or Snapchatting them or some cool thing that I don't know about. And there are a couple of commentaries. This is a weird, I'll throw it out there. It's probably wrong, but I thought it was interesting that some people believe that she then ended up being cloistered in a house in the woods, dedicated to God. She was not allowed to marry, have contact, and she would like get food and stuff. And so every year the friends would like go and visit her, like in this little prison. I don't buy that one. It sounds a little hinky to me, but that's, I just throw that out so that you know that. Yeah, Rich. I don't know if they utilize this as a text that proves that type of thing, but it very much sounds like this. We know that God is not interested in child sacrifice, even when we get to the very, very almost child sacrifice that took place in Genesis 22. The very near sacrifice, Abraham about to kill his son Isaac, and that was another thing when God says no. That's not going to happen. And the only time a child, and I don't know if we would say is sacrificed, it sounds a little weird, but the only other time when a child ends up giving his life because of a request from the Father is when Jesus does this by hanging on a cross and sacrificing his life for us. And now he didn't have any descendants, yeah. Yeah. Any way you slice it, either she's dead and Jephthah's an idiot, or she's alive and Jephthah's still an idiot. Or
he dedicated her to the church and sacrificed the first part of her body out the door.
First body part out the door, cut off the toe or something like that might be it. Because, you know, the other thing, and we don't really know a lot of the mechanics on some of this too, because God also said something. By the way, your firstborn belongs to God. Did you know that? Your firstborn belongs to God. And then the firstborn is to be redeemed. Do you know how you redeem your firstborn? Through the death of either a goat or a lamb. A perfect lamb, an unblemished goat or lamb that was offered to God. All supposed to be this picture and symbol of Jesus Christ and his death and his resurrection for us. Jim?
We got it.
And do what? Yeah, I don't know. Maybe, you know what? Maybe Jephthah's wife is dead. I mean, it's weird she's not mentioned in this. Like I said, if you were the wife and your husband comes home, honey, I got to kill the kid today. Please don't go, oh, that's a great idea. Let's do that. Maybe you don't like him. No, you would probably stop him. So there's the hint that maybe this was... What? Okay, so that was really academic and interesting, but what's the point of the story? There's several points. First of all, go back to Jephthah and who he was. God uses stupid people. Praise God. Because I'm probably one of the worst. If you don't believe me, ask my wife. God uses people who have checkered pasts and sordid histories. God uses people who don't have their entire act together, and God uses them in wonderful and glorious ways. And there's times when we make a vow to God, and God actually expects us to keep it. Now, God also gave us another thing where he said, just don't make the vow. Just let your yes be yes and your no be no. Don't make vows. Just simply say, I'm a truthful and honorable person. I'm going to follow whatever God says. And when we live in that way, we realize that God doesn't delight in the death of children. He doesn't delight in child sacrifice. He didn't delight in the death of his own son, but he knew that that was the only way to redeem mankind back to himself. And that's what we also see a picture of here. Let's pray. Whew, Lord, when I think of Jephthah, his background,